Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSec forum called Who is the Prosecutor Here? Rule 48A and the Michael Flynn, January 6th, and Eric Adams cases. Speaking with us today, we are joined by Professor Paul Cassell, Andrew McCarthy, and William Shipley. Moderating the discussion today, we have the Honorable John Richter, who is a partner at King & Spalding. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, John, thanks for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Well, thank you, Edith, and thanks to everyone who's attending. And let me begin. Again, I'm John Richter. I serve as the chairman of the Federalist Society's Criminal Law Procedure Executive Committee, and am pleased to moderate. We're going to focus on Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 48A, which reads, quote, the government may, with leave of court, dismiss an indictment, information, or complaint. The government may not dismiss the prosecution during trial without the defendant's consent, unquote. As the prompt for this panel has made clear, this rule has been recently used by the Department of Justice in cases like the Mayor Eric Adams case and the January 6 cases, also in the Michael Flynn case. In all of these instances, the judges in various ways have questioned the reasons for the dismissals and revealed some unsolved conflicts between permissive and restrictive views of the judge's role. And therefore, that tees up our panel discussion today. Fortunately, we have a panel that's very well positioned to do this. I know Edith covered the biographies of each of them, and I won't go deep into it. But I do want to note Bill Shipley, who operates out of Hawaii in the law office of the same name, and who spent many years as a prosecutor before becoming a defense counsel. As many of you may know, he represented dozens of defendants charged with various offenses stemming from the events on January 6, 2020, in and around our nation's capital, and thus brings a well-earned perspective about the law enforcement resources devoted to and the process used on these defendants, and how the D.C. District Court judges responded when the defendants whom he represented were pardoned by President Trump and the DOJ moved to dismiss those cases under Rule 48A. And of course, we have Andy McCarthy, who formerly was in the Department of Justice for many years, prosecuted the blind sheik. He's a best-selling author and contributed an editor in National Review, and has written and commented most recently on the dismissal of the Eric Adams case. And finally, we have Professor Paul Cassell from the University of Utah. As many of you know, well known to the Federalist Society, Professor Cassell is a former United States District Judge for the United States District Court for the District of Utah. He brings more than 40 years of legal experience, having, and also is a leading spokesman for protecting the rights of crime victims and regularly represents victims in criminal cases, and therefore brings an experienced perspective on the rights of crime victims as it may apply to Rule 48A. I'm going to turn it over now to Professor Cassell to cover a little bit of the history of Rule 48A, and then we'll get into these cases. Paul?
Well, thanks, John. And I suppose, as befits a Federalist Society presentation, we should probably begin with text history and tradition here. And we'll be assuming, of course, and focusing on the federal criminal justice system, so everyone is familiar with that. The topic of dismissals, though, is an interesting one if you look at the history. Historically, there's always been this right of and I've pulled out my Black's Law Dictionary here. There's been this history of, according to Black's Law Dictionary, nolle pros aequi, I believe is the way it's properly pronounced, frequently shortened to null pros. And the idea was, look, if the prosecutor has authority to decide what charges to file, the prosecutor could decide to, I don't know, unfile them or dismiss them. And historically, that was within the sole discretion of federal prosecutors. And historically, too, there was a rule in the states that was followed conventionally where prosecutors could dismiss charges. But over time, beginning around the Civil War and following, the states began to impose judicial review requirements, very loose requirements, but requirements that the court take a look at the dismissal. And this issue came to a head in the federal system in 1941 when the U.S. Supreme Court appointed the Advisory Committee for Rules of Criminal Procedure. And so they began to look at what should the rules be for dismissals. And they saw the existing federal practice that it was within the sole discretion of prosecutors. But they specifically decided to change the federal practice. And if you look at Rule 48A that you mentioned, John, you read the advisory committee notes right under that. I think that's literally the first sentence in the advisory committee notes. We're now changing the practice to require that dismissals be with leave of court. And so that's then the question for today, I suppose, and in question being raised in these cases that you alluded to, what does it mean to say that the judiciary has a role to grant or presumably deny leave of court when the government files a dismissal motion?
So, Andy and Bill, let's turn now and let me tee up for you these cases. Obviously, the Michael Flynn case, the Eric Adams case, and the many cases involving the January 6th defendants all have involved ultimately motions to dismiss under Rule 48A, but the courts have treated them in many different ways. Let me turn to the two of you, and maybe you can tee up sort of the various ways in which the courts have addressed these and give a little bit of procedural posture to begin with on how it came that a motion was filed in the Michael Flynn case, how it came that a motion was filed in the Eric Adams case, and how it came to be that the motion, the 48A motions were filed in the January 6th cases.
Well, I guess I'll start with Flynn, but I, you know, John and my fellow panelists, I've been trying to strain what's left in my brain to remember a controversial Rule 48 issue in the nearly 20 years I was in the Southern District of New York, and I couldn't come up with one. That doesn't mean we didn't have one, obviously. It's just there was not one that was that notorious. I don't know if that's because we had a lot of judges on our bench who had been prosecutors. I don't know if there's a better explanation for it, but it's interesting that the cases arise in these political contexts. In the case of Flynn, he was the first Trump administration's initial national security advisor. The FBI did a brace interview of him on his first day on the job in the White House. It was not authorized by the Justice Department. It was in violation of their protocols for interviewing White House staffers. The interviewing agents actually concluded that Flynn did not lie about his contacts with the Russian ambassador. No charges were filed at that time. Months later, after Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel, his staff went back to the Flynn case. Flynn later claimed that they pressured him with FARA charges, to bring FARA charges against foreign agency Registration Act, those kind of charges against his son, when he initially pled guilty, he didn't make a claim that anyone had tried to pressure him or induce him in any way. But he did later say that that happened. In any event, he agreed to plead guilty. He pled guilty before Judge Emmett Sullivan. And I think part of Judge Sullivan's ire as the case went on goes back to the Rule 11 allocution, because it was pretty unremarkable in that Flynn under oath allocuted that he was pleading guilty because he was guilty and said that nobody was coercing him. While Flynn was awaiting sentence and after the final Mueller report was filed, Attorney General Barr directed a number of investigations into the way that the so-called Russiagate probe was handled. One of them was in connection with Flynn. The Justice Department under Barr ultimately decided to dismiss the indictment against Flynn on the ground that the FBI shouldn't have been interviewing him in the first place because there wasn't enough ground for a criminal investigation, which was a fairly controversial finding by Attorney General Barr. I think it obviously didn't sit well with Judge Sullivan. And basically, Judge Sullivan refused to act on the dismissal. There's some mismemory about that. A lot of people, when they tell this sad tale, talk about him denying the motion. He basically just refused to act on the motion. The Justice Department got initially a fairly favorable panel when they tried to mandamus him to the D.C. Circuit. They seemed inclined to order the judge to act on the Rule 48 motion. An en banc of the court then ruled the other way and said that they wouldn't force him to act. I think the fair reading of those cases is they sure hoped he would act, but he ultimately didn't. He appointed an amicus, the former federal judge John Gleason, to give him advice on the case. Former Judge Gleason advised him that he could refuse to dismiss the case. He was a little bit hazy about what should happen next, which is interesting because I think that's going to be a lot of our discussion today, the issue about whether he could appoint a special counsel or order the government to proceed with the case. And I think part of the reason that there's haziness in the record on this is simply because Judge Sullivan didn't act one way or the other and never wrote anything to kind of explain himself. And the bottom line is the time was running out in the Trump administration, and Sullivan figured that if he didn't act, Trump would have to pardon Flynn, and that's ultimately what happened. Quickly on the Adams case, he's indicted for corruption by the Southern District of New York. They open a grand jury investigation. They have a continuing grand jury that's talking about superseding with additional obstruction charges. Trump wins the 2024 election. Adams lobbies him, and his lawyers lobby the White House counsel and then lobby Acting Deputy Attorney General Emil Bove. Bove directs the Southern District prosecutors to dismiss the Adams indictment without prejudice. He stresses that he's not casting aspersions against the prosecutors on the case, but he claims that the case was first brought for an improper motive to influence the mayoral election. And he says that the dismissal is necessary to secure Adams' cooperation on Trump's immigration enforcement agenda. These rationalizations, the prosecutors counter, don't match with the facts of the case. That's one of the big controversies here. But to focus in on Rule 48, what they were most disturbed about was the without prejudice term that the Justice Department wanted on the dismissal, because the prosecutors felt that this smacked of a quid pro quo, that they were keeping the charges open like a sword of Damocles on Adams to ensure that he would continue to press Trump's immigration enforcement agenda, which is not exactly popular in New York City among Adams's constituents. Basically, the bottom line here was Beauvais had to file the motion himself, the Rule 48 motion, because the Southern District prosecutors and some of the Justice Department prosecutors resigned over this. Judge Dale Ho, who caught the case in the Southern District, appointed Paul Clement as an amicus. Paul advised Judge Ho that he had no basis to decline to dismiss the motion or to order the government to prosecute the case, but that the court does have authority to rule on the effect of the dismissal. It can put the Justice Department to the choice of dismissing the case with prejudice or allowing them to proceed with the case. And the argument there was that the with prejudice or without prejudice, that whole business, Rule 48 is there, the argument was, for the protection of the defendant. And the idea is that dismissal with without prejudice, which allows the government to bring the charges again, is one that can be an abuse of prosecutorial power. The interesting procedural thing here, as I close on this, is that Adams then filed a motion to dismiss with prejudice, arguing that the Southern District prosecutors had committed misconduct. The Justice Department didn't respond to that, and Judge Ho used their lack of a response basically to interpret it as their agreement that the case should be dismissed with prejudice. And as one of my colleagues on the panel has quipped, at that point, Judge Ho, armed with Clement's recommendation, managed to squeeze a two-paragraph opinion into 78 pages. Ultimately, the bottom line of that is he followed Clement's advice. He dismissed the case with prejudice. He concluded he had no authority to order the Justice Department to continue the prosecution, but he rejected the attacks on the Southern District prosecutors. He rejected some of the pretexts that the Justice Department had for dismissing the case, and he did express concern about the quid pro quo, but mostly used his opinion to give vent to those concerns. Bottom line here is the case was dismissed with prejudice.
Right, Bill. Let's, if you can, just tee up sort of how it got to a Rule 48A motion with the January 6th defendants.
Okay, and that was me, Andy, was referring to with the two paragraphs spread over 78 pages. Before we turn to the January 6th stuff, let me add something to what Professor Cassell mentioned. You know, sort of the historical oddity of the four words with leave of court in Rule 48A is dealt with in a limited degree in footnote 15 of the Supreme Court's decision in a case called Rinaldi versus United States. And in footnote 15, you know, if you want to know what the meaning, what with leave of court means in the context of Rule 48A, the answer to that is nobody knows. And that comes from the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court said in the footnote, the words leave of court were inserted in Rule 48A without explanation. And they were inserted by Congress at the last step of the adoption of the rule. The last step is after the Judicial Conference approves them, they go to Congress. Congress has 7 months to modify them or reject them or accept them. And it was in that period that Congress inserted the words with leave of court without explanation. And it's been left to the Supreme Court and the lower courts to figure out what that means. In the context of the January 6th cases, we had the somewhat surprising at the time it came decision by the newly elected president to pardon everybody or otherwise favorably dispose of their cases. Not every case was a pardon. Pardons only applied to the cases that were already final. With regard to cases not yet final, meaning they were either still pending in the district court or
or they had been final in the district court, but were pending in the appellate court, the Department of Justice began filing motions to dismiss. In the appellate court, I believe the procedural posture they took was essentially a motion to vacate the convictions below, in other words, stipulating to reversal on appeal, and then with instructions by the appellate court to the district court to dismiss. And the case is still pending in the district court. The government just filed straightforward motions to dismiss under Rule 48A. I went back and took a look at some of those. At the time, I don't have an exact number, but I had about 35 to 40 cases still pending in the district court at that point. Either had not yet been to trial, or I had, I think, five or six, maybe a couple more, that had been to trial and were pending sentencing. There was quite a rush of efforts to get cases completed in the fall of 2024 for some reason that just escaped me. So as a general proposition, you have 16, 17, 18 district court judges, including the senior judges, with a few hundred cases spread among them. Some of them just began granting the dismissals the following day. And the government's dismissals, the motions were all specifically made for dismissal with prejudice under Rule 48A. And some of the judges just went right through their docket, granted the motion, and entered an order of dismissal without any response or input by the defendants. But four judges, and I've gone back and confirmed this now, four judges, Judge Howell, the former presiding judge, Judge Chutkin, Judge Friedman, who is a senior status judge, and Judge Ali Khan, who's a brand new judge, the four of them declined to enter the dismissals with prejudice and instead signed orders dismissing the cases without prejudice. Three of those, Judge Howell, Judge Chutkin, and Judge Friedman, wrote long opinions setting forth their views of the propriety of the motions. Didn't really address the with or without prejudice issue, I don't think, in any substantive way. I'm sure they did. I've got to admit, I didn't go back and read them closely for purposes of today's session. But in effect, they did what, on different grounds, they did what Judge Ho did. They voiced their views as to the propriety of moving to dismiss the cases based upon, you know, the global facts and processes that had, applied to those cases up to this point.
Well, great. So let's turn now, I think, to some of the meat. I think there are really two issues that are worthy of some in-depth consideration here. First is the interest that a deciding court must or should or has considered in deciding a motion to dismiss by the government under 48A. Obviously, this takes into account the with or without prejudice question, which is after we're done discussing this, I want to turn to what happens or should happen when a court doesn't want to or doesn't grant the motion, the government's motion, or only grants it without prejudice, leaving the case potentially open for prosecution later. So let's turn right now in terms of what we are seeing in terms of the grounds and the interests that should be recognized by the district courts, what we're seeing in the precedent to date with these cases, and where we think it ought to go. Let me turn, I guess, first maybe to you, Bill, in terms of thinking about it from the perspective of the defendants.
I have a relatively strident and simple view on this, and I formed it really for the first time when I did some research into it and wrote a little bit about it with respect to General Flynn's case back in, I guess that was 2020. there was a decision that in the D.C. Circuit called, I just referred to it briefly as the Focker Services, F-O-K-K-E-R, which was a circuit court decision dealing with a Rule 48 question, 48A question. And I thought, you know, and that case, you know, sort of traced some of the older case law in other circuits. My recollection is the Fifth Circuit had a handful of cases going back several decades. And I thought the conclusion the D.C. Circuit came to is probably the best explanation. And that is that relying on Supreme Court language that, you know, it is the province of the prosecutor, it is the executive function to bring a prosecution and to end a prosecution, to make a decision to terminate a prosecution. And that so long as there is a facially legitimate purpose, it is not, the court might have a different opinion, but it is not the judicial function to disagree or go behind that facially legitimate purpose. And the cases that I think were out of the Fifth Circuit that the D.C. Circuit focused on, the one famous one is a prosecutor who dismissed a case on the eve of his own vacation because he didn't want it to interfere with his vacation plans. And so he moved to dismiss it without prejudice so that he could come back later and refile it and go back, you know, to prosecute the case. The Rinaldi case is another example, the actual case Rinaldi versus United States. In that instance, I believe the facts were that the prosecutor had initiated a second or subsequent prosecution of a defendant who'd been previously convicted in state court. And that was a violation of the what's long been known as the Pettit policy in DOJ to not bring a federal prosecution based on the same facts behind a state court conviction. And in that case, the prosecutor represented to the court that he had obtained the necessary internal clearances and approvals to bring the second prosecution in federal court. And all of that turned out to be false. So the government stepped in his office. He was, I don't know, he was terminated or suspended or whatever. And his office stepped in to move to dismiss that case on the basis of his internal violations. Again, I believe that case, much like the Adams case, the facts were overwhelming. There was no basis to say that the case was weak. The reason for the violation was simply the explanation that the prosecutor violated DOJ policy in bringing the case in the first instance. So that led back to the conclusion of Focker Services that while the judiciary, the judge involved might disagree, as long as there's not a bad faith policy decision or individualized decision by a prosecutor to move to dismiss a case, it is the judgment of the executive that counts. And so the grounds for disagreeing with the policy reasons or particular reasons in a particular case put forward carry the day. On behalf of defendants, you know, obviously, as indicated, as it worked out in the Adams case, as Andy just referred to, when the issue as to with or without prejudice became controversial, Adams' lawyers jumped in and filed a motion for with prejudice because, you know, a defendant, that's always what you'd like to see. You don't want the case to come back, you know, for any particular reason or based on any particular cause in the future. So you always, you know, in the back of your mind as a practitioner, I always think, what's the practical possibility of this ever coming back on my client? You have statute of limitations problems, you know, other kinds of issues, prosecutorial misconduct issues might raise their head, as happened in the Adams case. I think the motion for dismissal with prejudice, and Andy can correct me if I'm wrong, I haven't read it real closely, was that the public commentary between DOJ and the former prosecutors who had resigned out of SDNY, you know, in effect was an improper public commentary on the facts of the case and prejudging Adams's guilt, and therefore created an environment, you know, tantamount to prosecutorial misconduct. And that was a basis, they argued, to have it dismissed with prejudice.
That's right.
So Andy and Paul, in terms of seeing it from the court's perspective when they get one of these motions, obviously Bill's made the point that that ultimately, in his view, it's really up to the executive branch. As but what are the what and from your view from what are the interests that the deciding courts have taken into account and should be taken into account in deciding the motion? You know, we've heard differing approaches in terms of even in the between the Flynn, Adams, and January 6th defendants in which in the way the courts have come at this. Some seemingly have just acceded to the wishes of the government and immediately dismissed without comment, and some have acceded to the wishes, but over a strenuous with strenuous commentary, and some of them have granted it without prejudice, meaning the case could be brought. And in other cases, obviously the Flynn case, as you pointed out, Andy, the court refused to rule and left it essentially to the President Trump in his first term to issue a pardon, which obviously then led to the dismissal of the case based on that ground rather than the court making a decision and a judgment about the government's motion, pre-existing motion. So what do you, guys, in terms of the defendant's interests and other interests here, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, let me jump in and give sort of an academic perspective. And I know Andy is very well situated there in New York to comment on the Adams case and some of the others. If you step back, I think Bill has pointed out, look, we have one Supreme Court decision here, and it says essentially, like, we really don't know what this leave of court provision means. I think if you look at the case law, and there isn't a lot of case law out there, Andy flagged that point for us at the start here. This isn't something that's litigated routinely. But I think two schools of thought have developed. They're not necessarily competing, but some courts say, look, this leave of court provision was designed to protect the defendant. Other courts say, well, that's true, but there's an additional public interest component that has to be considered as part of the process here. Well, let me be clear. I'm in that second camp. I think there is a public interest component that has to be considered. And let me give a couple of arguments for that school of thought. Obviously, I think everybody would agree that if the government is dismissing just to harass the defendant, they're not ready to go on Monday, but they can get him next week or whatever, when that kind of thing would be a reason to question what the government is doing. But I think there is a text, history, and tradition argument for a public interest component here that extends beyond the interests of defendants. The first is, if you take a look at the text of Rule 48A, the first sentence says with leave of court, and then the second sentence says if there's going to be a dismissal during trial, it has to be with the consent of the defendant. If the sole purpose of this rule was to protect defendants, it would have been an easy matter to just write one sentence and say, look, yeah, they can dismiss, but they got to get defense approval. I think the text indicates they were looking at something beyond defense interest. Secondly, if you look at the history of the rule, and Bill flagged a little bit of that for us, the previous rule was prosecutors could do whatever they want, but this rule was designed to specifically change that, so it must have been envisioning some sort of judicial review. And third, if you look at tradition, I mentioned earlier that the states had originally gone with generally an approach that said prosecutors have discretion, but that changed over time. And I think the federal rule reflects the tradition in this country of changing to give judicial oversight. One last point that I want to flag now, and we may circle back to it, is also if you look at another provision of law in the federal system, the Crime Victims' Rights Act, there is, in my view, a right of crime victims to object to a dismissal and have that considered. And that's where I think a public interest component is necessarily assumed, because if the victims are just talking to the judge with no possibility of affecting the outcome, then that wouldn't have been something to enshrine in federal law. So I do think there is a public interest component. I agree prosecutors should have deference, but then it becomes a very interesting question about whether some of these dismissals are or are not in the public interest.
Andy, how do you see it?
Yeah, I'm essentially in Bill's camp that the main reason for the rule is to protect the rights of the defendant. I agree with Paul that we're writing largely on a clean slate with respect to a provision that obviously hasn't been nailed down in the jurisprudence. I'm not overwhelmed by the point that you need consent of the defendant during trial, but not before, because it seems to me that during trial, once the trial started, jeopardy is attached. So you're in a very different posture than you are pre-trial. And it seems to me that it would be constitutionally controversial to suggest that you need the defendant's permission at a stage of the proceedings before the trial has started, when it's really up to the government, the prosecution, whether it wants to proceed with the case or not. I am generally of a mind that the court's function in a criminal setting is to protect the rights of the defendant. I was trying to come up with analogs to this situation from my own experience. It's always a danger to rely too much on your own experience. But one I thought of was the FISA situation, which is kind of interesting, because FISA has a procedure where if the court rules that certain classified information is necessary for the defendant to get a fair trial, the attorney general can actually overrule the court and direct that evidence not come into the case. But then the court, if the judge decides the defendant can't get a fair trial, can either dismiss counts or dismiss the whole indictment. And it just seems to me that it illustrates a neat divide of what the court's responsibility is versus what the executive branch's responsibility is in the number of situations, and they're not altogether too few, where those two things clash in the criminal context. I think the court is essentially there to protect the rights of the defendant, and I just think that if you cross into the idea that there's this sort of vague general public interest role that the court plays, where that isn't nailed down in a very exacting way in rules and regulation, it really does invite the court to usurp powers of the government in a way that would be constitutionally very dubious.
Well, obviously this panel is sponsored not just by the criminal law and procedure executive committee, but also by the separation of powers executive committee. And Andy, you've teed up nicely this separation of powers question. And Paul, you've also by raising the argument on and the perspective about the interest of justice prong to a court's consideration, it opens up the question of well, where does the court go if the court believes that the interest of justice, it not only disagrees with the decision to dismiss the case but it chooses to deny the motion in the interest of justice, given that the United States Department of Justice and the United States attorneys, therefore, in the matter, no longer are authorized or wish to proceed with the matter.
John, before we go down that road, let me see if I can give Andy an analog and ask the professor's response to this. Because I dealt with this in the district court in a January 6th case, had a couple of heated, spirited debates with a couple of different judges. The representative of the public interest in a criminal trial where there are two advocates for the two sides is the Justice Department. And an analog was an argument that we had over the Speedy Trial Act. And you have two tracks, or you have two sources for the right to speedy trial. You have a constitutional provision to a public and speedy trial, but that is in the Bill of Rights, and it runs only to the defendant. That only gives the defendant the constitutional right to speedy trial. Those don't guarantee any rights to the government. So then you have the Speedy Trial Act, which is a statute, and I got into heated debates with judges about whether or not the public has a right to a speedy trial, and who advocates for that. Well, the government is the one that wanted to get quickly to trials, whereas the defense was trying to put the brakes on things to gather more information, just to slow the process down, to have more time to prepare. You know, a myriad of reasons why the defense might want to go slower. And the judges would argue, well, don't I have an obligation to take into consideration the public's interest in a speedy trial under the Speedy Trial Act? Yes, but that's because it's being advocated for by the government. If the government's not asking for a speedy trial, you know, if the government's amenable to another 6 months and the defense is asking for another 6 months, does the court insert itself at that point and say, well, but the public's interest is in having a trial in 6 weeks?
Let me just amplify your point. By the way, the Crime Victims' Rights Act says crime victims have the right to proceedings free from unreasonable delay. So there may be situations where I think the court has to say, I don't care what the two parties say, there's a broader public or crime victims' interest here.
Yeah, and as we discussed in our discussion setting this up, your introduction of the issue of the crime victim's interests on this subject is something that it never really entered my thinking, because it had never arisen in a case where it became a meaningful issue. But it does present some fascinating questions that take us into a realm of analysis that is not really treated in the existing case law, because the Crime Victims Act is relatively recent. It's been around for a while now, but it hasn't been litigated particularly in this context. But yeah, it creates another whole layer of analysis. But I still go back to the point, the advocate for the public's interest is not the judiciary, it's the government, even in terms of the Crime Victims Recovery Act.
Yeah,
that's the government asserting it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I also think that what is in the public interest for the court to do is to protect the rights of the defendant. To the extent that there is an overarching judicial interest in the legitimacy of the proceedings, and therefore the public perception of that, and the public interest is seen in that light, the judge's job is to protect the defendant from overbearing conduct by the prosecutor. I also think in connection with Bill's experience, there's an overlay here that's important to point out, which is that in connection with the prosecutions of President Trump by the Justice Department, which was at least equally, if not more important to the Biden-Harris Justice Department as were the January 6 cases, they were explicitly taking the position in court that the public had an interest in a speedy trial of Trump. And I always thought that they took that position as a pretext for what otherwise would have been the blatantly obvious improper fact that they were gunning to get ahead of the election calendar, the election schedule, and rather than crassly come out and say, look, we got to get this guy to trial before the election so that we can get him convicted before the election, what they tried to do was put lipstick on the pig by saying there's a speedy trial issue here. But the only speedy trial issue in the case is, or the main one is, depending on the complexity of the case, and especially if you're in a situation like Trump was, where the Justice Department indicted him in two different places, 1,000 miles away from each other, and wanted him to go to trial in both of them, complex cases, one of them rife with classified information, and yet they wanted to get both of them to trial prior to the 2024 election. the speedy trial issue there is, does the defendant have enough time and enough access to the information that he needs in order to prepare for his defense in a constitutionally adequate manner? And I think, to the extent, Paul, that you point out that the crime victims are entitled that there not be unreasonable delay, I really think that, you know, unreasonable does a lot of work in that sentence. I think that, you know, what makes it reasonable or unreasonable depends on the complexity of the case and what the defendant needs to prepare for trial.
Yeah, I agree that defendant's interests have to be given a significant consideration. But since we're playing the analogy game, I think I've got a strong analogy here for public interest review. Plea bargaining, Rule 11. I mean, I think we're all former federal prosecutors here, and we know generally if we come up with a plea deal, if the federal prosecutor has a plea deal, it's going to be blessed by the judge. But once in a blue moon, the judge could say, look, I'm just not signing on to this thing. It is against the public interest. And you can find examples of judges being affirmed on appeal where they have rejected plea agreements because they were too lenient or otherwise didn't serve the public interest. And a public interest component here to Rule 48. I mean, that's not some newfangled thing. The leading case on it is from the Fifth Circuit, the Cowan case in 1975. It was recently reaffirmed in a case that I argued to the Fifth Circuit, coincidentally, against Paul Clement in connection with the case I'm working on, crime victims' families in the Boeing case. And the Fifth Circuit in In Re Ryan said very clearly that there is a public interest determination that has to be made before before charges are dismissed. Now, let me be clear. In staking out that ground, I'm not saying the judges should be micromanaging the Justice Department. There's going to be a heavy thumb on the scale in favor of the prosecution's motion. But I don't think the case law supports the proposition, perhaps, that my fellow panelists are staking out, that there is no public interest role for the court to play in looking at these kinds of issues.
Let me take up a question here from our audience, which I think nicely tees up kind of where this goes. If, Paul, you're right that essentially there is an interest that has to be considered beyond simply the government's wishes and the defendant's wishes, and that is somehow leads to the matter continuing, essentially. And and our audience member asks, even assuming a judge denies the government's motion to dismiss, what is the practical effect? That the court forces a trial where the government does not present evidence? What are the options here? And this tees up sort of our true separation of powers question. If there are interests that the judge believes outweigh the interests of the prosecutor, and the defendant in seeking to have this dismissed. So playing out your position, Paul, that the victim's interests mean that this matter should go forward. And as a practical matter, how could it move forward?
Yeah, let me just take 1 minute because I know my co-panelists disagree, but I think my position is very consistent. If there is a public interest component to this determination and the judge says, doggone it, I've heard the prosecutor, I've considered the defense interest, this is not in the public interest to dismiss, well, at that point, one would hope that first the prosecutor might take that into account and move forward with the case. But if that does not happen, secondly, then I believe the judiciary is empowered to appoint a special prosecutor, if we want to use the statutory term, a special counsel, to move forward with the case. And there are the hints of support for that proposition in a case, the Vuitton case, Young versus, it's one of these ex-rel cases where the Supreme Court affirmed, or at least, well, it overturned in that particular case, but affirmed the right of a district court judge to appoint a prosecutor to vindicate a court order. In the Southern District of New York, there's a Donziger case a couple of years ago where a judge appointed a special prosecutor. Both of those are admittedly in a contempt context, but they establish the proposition that it is not, I think, unconstitutional in rare cases for a judge to appoint a prosecutor to vindicate a court order. So that would, in my view, that's what would happen, assuming that everybody said that they weren't going to move forward with the case.
Well, Andy, I know you've never said had anything to say about the use of special prosecutors. give us your thoughts here.
Yeah. Well, I actually hadn't, when we talked about this, when we were discussing what we were going to discuss, I gave a lot of thought to Paul's point about the contempt cases. I didn't think of it in terms of the appointments clause issue that came up in front of in the Florida prosecution of Trump, where they basically decided that Jack Smith hadn't been properly appointed, that he's a principal officer under the Constitution, and that he wielded enough power that he had to either be confirmed by the Senate or appointed in consistency with some statute that allowed the attorney general to make the appointment. So I don't know if there'd be an appointment clause complexity to Paul's suggestion. My own view of this, for what it's worth, is that the cases that Paul is talking about, and I think he's absolutely right that it is an extension of this principle that I would certainly find troubling for separation of powers purposes. But it is at least the one thing you can say about it is in defense of the court's own processes. And it would be a finite kind of prosecution where you wouldn't have to tap much the resources, the prosecutorial resources of the executive branch. I think as a practical matter, if you're talking about the normal Justice Department case, that is not something that can be handled by a prosecutor appointed by the court who can just make the case on the basis of the record of contemptuous conduct in the presence of the court. Most federal prosecutions are pretty complicated. Certainly the ones we're talking about today are extraordinarily complicated. They require multiple prosecutors, lots of agency resources. I guess the question is, if you were to embrace this principle, how far would you take it? Are you saying that the court has the capacity to basically command or commandeer limitless resources to prosecute these cases? Because I don't think that's practical. And I would think that if a case like this got up to the appellate courts and the Supreme Court, ultimately, they would be reluctant to extend that principle outside the framework of cases that involve vindicating the court's own processes.
Now, we got a couple questions here from the audience that tie into this nicely. The questioner asks how there could be a basis for Article III jurisdiction if the court wants to dismiss the case. What's the case or controversy remaining? I'd note that Chief Justice Warren once wrote that those two words, case and controversy, have an iceberg quality, containing beneath their surface simplicity, submerged complexities which go to the very heart of our constitutional form of government. So given that, this seems like a pretty simple thing for the panelists to answer. Paul, how do you square this? If the judge can insist on the continued prosecution based on an interest of justice, or in this case, at least a belief that the victim's rights are not being vindicated, what's the authority upon which a so-called special prosecutor could be appointed if the U.S. Attorney, the Department of Justice, is not, the Attorney General is not willing to back it up.
So I think the case or controversy is clear. The judge would have pending on his or her docket an indictment alleging the defendant had committed a crime. And that would be a controversy that the judge would have jurisdiction to adjudicate. And I would point out, I understand that there are some questions clearly that could be and are being raised now by Andy and presumably Bill about this position. But there is a problem with the counter position, which is it essentially reads out of Rule 48, the leave of court provision. Because if you say, well, Judge, I know you're not giving us leave of court to dismiss, but then we're not doing anything at all, the leave of court provision then has no operative effect. So my position, I think, is consistent with the text of a rule that's existed for more than 80 years.
But isn't the, let me just play devil's advocate here. I mean, isn't the defendant's interest, which the court would take into account, and we see certainly in the Judge Adams case, Judge Ho making a determination that the case should be dismissed with prejudice to look out for effectively the a defendant's interest, as well as prevent the appearance, at least, of this of the quid pro quo about which the court writes, isn't that an interest sufficient by itself to constitute an interest? You know, the with leave of court prong of here.
Let me wrestle with the hypothetical, as I know law professors shouldn't do, but spin it around. Let's take a situation where the defendant says, no, doggone it, I need to go to trial now, I need to clear the air, and so forth. And the judge says, I agree, we're going to go to trial on this now to settle things. I would think the judge would have authority to enforce the order that this needs to go to trial now. Otherwise, the rule is essentially a one-way street. And that's, again, inconsistent with the history and tradition of the rule, which if you look at the broader landscape of the public interest test that exists in the other state, in other states and so forth, it does allow the judge to insist that the case move forward.
Andy, thinking about these contempt cases and what you've observed in the Southern District of New York in those cases, is there really a grounds to expand and think about this in terms of an appointment of an outside attorney to carry forward on an indictment that's been brought by the U.S. attorney?
I think it would really, it would have to be a very exactingly laid out rule, and there'd be a lot of constitutional challenge to it. The Justice Department takes the position that it is unilaterally up to the Justice Department whether we proceed with a case or not. I was thinking as Paul was talking that I always found as a prosecutor that Congress and the court don't like the idea of unilateral executive power, even though, like, somewhere deep down they know that the Article II and does give the executive branch a reservoir of its own power. Justice Jackson's famous concurrence in the Steele seizure case says that pretty explicitly. But the context I always think of is pen registers. You know, we used to have to go get the pen registers, and the way the Fourth Amendment law had been interpreted at the time, no one had a privacy interest in not having a pen register. There was case law that was on the books in the 1970s that said that you didn't have an expectation of privacy, which meant we shouldn't have to go to a court at all. We should be able to just go get a pen register. But Congress made us go get a pen register. Why? Because they don't like unilateral executive power. What would happen if a court denied? What legitimate possible basis could a court have to deny a pen register request? None. But you still had to go to get the court to sign off on it. And the court never likes the idea that it's a rubber stamp, but in that instance, it's a rubber stamp.
Paul, if the United States has moved to withdraw, moved to dismiss, And the court is looking at the victim's interest here and concludes that the case needs to move forward. Is the real party in interest, the United States, still in the case?
I think it is, because the charges are filed in the name of the United States, and that's the legal issue, the case or controversy that the court is asking to have decided. United States versus Smith or whoever the defendant is, that's what is being adjudicated. And one of the points I think you can make in defense of my position is, look, the government does have untrammeled authority to decide whether they want to push the indictment button. But once they push that button and launch an indictment, they have bought in, I would submit, to a Rule 48A review of any decision to pull that missile back, or whatever the right metaphor would be. So there is untrammeled authority to decide whether to launch, and very limited authority to decide whether to unlaunch.
If I can weigh in, it's been fascinating. I've just been listening for about 10 minutes here. I think the problem with that position is that at the stage where this decision has to be made, the defendant is still presumed innocent. And that was a problem with the General Flynn case. He'd already pled guilty. And that animated Judge Sullivan's point of view about what his options were was the fact that he had a case where the defendant had already confessed his guilt under oath in the Rule 11 proceeding. The circumstances we're talking about is where a defendant is still presumed innocent, and the executive is saying, for whatever reason, we do not choose to go forward. And for the judge to push it forward is in some ways surrendering the neutrality of the judiciary, because the judge is taking a position that the evidence here is so convincing that the trial must proceed to a verdict of guilt or innocence, when the executive has said, and there's, as you know, there's a lot of case law that says that decision to prosecute or not prosecute, you know, the exercise of prosecutorial discretion to not bring a case can be based on a variety of factors that have nothing to do with the evidence or guilt or innocence. Every case you bring means you can't bring another case because of limited resources. And so sometimes it's simply a prioritization of which cases you push forward. And the view that the judge on the case can insist that the case goes forward strikes me as kind of an uncodified independent counsel situation, because who's going to supervise that prosecutor if the Department of Justice has said we are not sponsoring the prosecution? And who's going to provide the budget and the resources and the office space and the equipment and the investigators? Is it all just going to be the product of judicial fiat that you have to do it? And because I say you have to do it, I understand your point. I just think the practical consequences, it creates so many more problems than it solves.
Well, we are up against our time, and this is obviously a topic that can continue to be debated. I certainly want to thank the Federal Society, and particularly the Separation of Powers and Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Groups, and Edith Harrell for making this webinar possible. And of course, thank you, Bill. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Andy, for your insights. And thank you to our audience.
Yeah, just to echo that, on behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Paul, Andrew, and William for speaking with us today, and John for moderating. We really appreciate your time and expertise. Thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your active participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.